Hello and welcome to Was Bitcoin Bringt, the Bitcoin podcast from Vienna, Austria, presented by Coinfinity. This time, we're going English again with my good old friend Luke Roman. He's the editor of Forest for the Trees. He's a very well-known person in the Bitcoin, gold and general finance space. And he's very, very deep into the whole history of money, gold and Bitcoin. He has his own views on where we're heading with the political and the financial situation in the world. This is a very recent interview I did. It's a pretty long interview, but I promise it's worth it. Apricot Media is the first, only and best publisher of German language books on Bitcoin. Their bestseller is The Bitcoin Standard by Seyfeddin Amous, and they just published Layered Money by Nick Bhatia. On their website apricot.media, you can order books and pay using the Lightning Network. Coinfinity is Austria's first Bitcoin broker and your partner for the long-term Bitcoin strategy. They have excellent support and fair prices, and a focus on customer satisfaction. Coinfinity is a firm run by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. You can find their physical store in the city of Graz and reach their website from everywhere, coinfinity.co. Incrementum is an independent asset manager, a fund manager, and a research firm based in Liechtenstein. The Incrementum partners Ronald Stöffele and Mark Wallet are experts on the topic of sound money and the Austrian School of Economics. They published a legendary Ingobi Trust Report, where I am also an author. Find them at incrementum.li. It's my enormous pleasure to welcome Luke Roman from Forest for the Trees. Hi, Luke. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Nico. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Like I just told you, I've gotten my COVID break behind me now. Everybody's is out and about again, and we are happy and hope it stays this way. Thank you so much for taking the time. This is not the first time we've been talking. We've been talking for a couple of years now, and there are some, you know, subjects that we're both covering, like gold and Bitcoin and the international monetary system, and things are heating up, so to say, right now. I want to go back in time now. I want to start at the beginning. You know, someone once said, everybody knows where we have been. Let's see where we are going. But I don't think that everybody actually knows where we have been. So can you give me, like, can you start at in 1944? Can you just give me the rundown of how we got here? And maybe I'll just, you know, do some breaks in the middle.
Sure. So yeah, 1944, by that point, it was apparent at the leadership levels of the Allies that we were going to win the war. It was just a question of what, how long it would take, what that looked like. And so they began the work of shaping what the post-war and the post-war financial economic system would look like. They met at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in the United States. And there were two proposals. There was the John Maynard Keynes proposal, which was a bancor, as he called it, which was a neutral settlement asset tied to commodities where imbalances would be settled in bancor. And so over time, if you ran deficits, you would have to, your currency would weaken against the bancor. The price of the bancor would rise against your currency, and creditor countries would see the price of the bancor fall against their currencies, and as a result, there would be a balancing of deficits or financial imbalances that worked out on a real time basis. And that was the Keynes proposal. The counter proposal was the United States proposal. I believe it was Harry Dexter White, and that was the U.S. dollar, the pegged to gold at $35 per ounce, and then every other currency in the world tied to the dollar. And arguably, the bancor was the better proposal objectively in terms of from objective economics, but realpolitik won out. As I've said, the Americans at that point had all the factories, all the men, all the military, they were the world's biggest oil producer, and we had by far the most gold. And so they went with the American proposal. You go forward after the war, nations and regions that had historically been very productive got back on their feet and proceeded to be very productive, specifically Germany, Korea, Japan. And the U.S. started running deficits again. In the early days, that was a designed political move to help these regions rebuild after the war. As time wore on, it was partially due to increasing productivity of those other regions, partially due to an inability of the U.S. to constrain deficit spending. At any rate, we fast forward to 1971, everything comes to a head as by the mid-60s, it was apparent to, in particular, European creditors that the United States could not maintain the parity, that peg at $35 per ounce. The amount of offshore dollar balances were not going to be able to be made good at $35 an ounce. And so there began to be repatriations of that gold at that rate. They raised the rate from $35 to $42 per ounce once, which was 20% devaluation of the dollar in gold terms. And then finally, Nixon in 71 closed the gold window, just said it's the dollar is no longer good for gold to international creditors. As a reality, people forget that it's been a progression, that the Americans defaulted on their gold obligations to the domestic creditors in 1933 when it was made illegal. And then we defaulted Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Domestic creditors would be Americans, right?
Americans, yeah. Americans.
People in America were not allowed to own any gold under the so-called gold standard of Bretton Woods.
Yes, exactly. It was illegal for Americans to own gold domestically from 1933 till, I believe, 1974. And so we had already defaulted. The government already defaulted on Americans in 71. Or in 1933. And then in 1971, the American government defaulted on foreign creditors, the gold clause. And then we were into this new system where, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let me stop there before we go to the new system of the last five decades. You started with Keynes had the idea. As a Brit, he came to New Hampshire, he came to the Bretton Woods conference. He said, okay, we looked at this. It's better to have a neutral reserve currency, right?
Yep.
And the Americans said, no, how about no, right? but since then, when you look at the history, when you look at, Robert Triffin talking about this at the end of the 50s, and then even like the Europeans talking about this and the Chinese talking about this, basically like the minute Bretton Woods was done, it was clear that the idea that Keynes had was the better one. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And it's hard to say that Keynes was right as an Austrian, but he is right, right? And so what happened in between? I mean, when was the first time that we realized that, having a nation's currency as a world reserve currency is not the best idea?
I would say it was obvious to Triffin, as you noted, by the late 50s, right? Early 60s. And so he famously talked about Triffin's dilemma. It's named after him, that ultimately the problem is the U.S. has to run such deficits to supply the currency to the world that ultimately the U.S. would become so indebted that there would be a rejection of the currency at some point. And it was just a question of when. And so I think it was understood that this system, as most systems are in the natural world, would become a victim of its own success at some point. And success is a relative term. There were winners and losers within it. But all in all, the world functioned. And in particular, it's important, I think, to remember that at the time, there was an existential global geopolitical competition taking place in terms of the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. There was a constant threat to Europe in particular, fear of being overrun by the Soviets. And the Americans obviously had a big role in protecting Europe from that happening. And so there were winners and losers, but as long as the Soviet Union was a threat, it was effectively a cost that Europe was willing to bear, I think, by virtue of the security arrangement that came alongside that American system. And once the Soviet Union broke apart, suddenly one of the key reasons why I think Europe went along with that system was gone. There's no longer a security need.
But within this time frame from 1944 to 1971, Americans were not allowed to own gold. Europeans were allowed to own gold, and foreign governments and foreign central banks could get, you know, their gold for dollars. So the US starts at 20,000 tons, about 20,000, and ends at 8,000 in 1971, right? Do you know how many countries actually got their gold? Because we know that France got their gold and some other countries, and Germany explicitly didn't. And they were citing the security reasons, right? They were citing, okay, you protect us, we leave our gold with you.
Yeah, that's if I'm remembering right, the Blessing letter, right? Carl Blessing of the Bundesbank later wrote about that he had met with U.S. authorities, and I forget which U.S. Policymakers he met with, but the gist of the conversation, in not so many words, was if you start redeeming the gold like the French are doing and like the Belgians are doing and like the Dutch are doing, you know, we may have to revisit the number of troops that we have in West Germany. And so it wasn't a threat, but it was, the threat was sort of implied. It was hardline politics, hardline diplomacy. And so, the Germans did not repatriate their gold, as far as I understand, up to that point.
I don't know where I read this, but there was one argument that you know, resonated with me about 1944. The idea was that as long as there is this threat from the Soviet Union, you can't have a system with a really independent central bank where nobody can actually print their own money, because in case of a war, somebody needs to start printing money, and the US would be the only option. So that's why they went with the US instead of going with Keynes. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I don't know the degree of foresight that required that the Cold War would devolve the way it would. You know, I seem to remember in the, you know, 46 to 49 timeframe that there were some hopes, I think, that perhaps the US and Soviets could get along, and you know, that the détente they reached to fight Germany would hold. I don't remember off the top of my head exactly when that broke down. I suppose that's possible. I just don't know.
All right. So in 71, the Americans default on their gold obligations a second time, this time to the world, right? What happens then?
Well, then you're in this system that is sort of without an anchor in terms of how people had understood the system to work for the prior at least 150 years, really, right? And probably more like the past 300 years, really, since the Bank of England was founded in, what, I think 1694 or something. This had sort of one version or another of some sort of currency tied to gold had existed. And so I think they were at the policymakers, particularly in creditor region, Europe, Japan, were at a bit of a loss for what that meant. Our view is that effectively the U.S. played a masterful stroke of policy in setting up the petrodollar system with Treasury Secretary Bill Simon getting the Saudis, who were by then the biggest marginal producer in the world, to agree to price their oil only in dollars in return for a security guarantee. And there was a great clip of former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. He talked about that he had possession of a three-page document that Paul Volcker had put together at the behest of Kissinger in, I want to say, 70 or 71, where the recognition was that the U.S. was going to go from being a surplus to a deficit permanently. And that historically, when empires had gone from being surplus to deficit, that was the end of the empire. The empire then broke apart. And so Kissinger charged Volcker, who was, I think, an assistant undersecretary of the Treasury or something at that point, with coming up with a way that the U.S. could remain hegemonic. And these were Kissinger's terms, according to Varoufakis, even though we were going from this surplus to deficit position structurally. And what Volcker came up with was we need to recycle other people's surpluses. We no longer have surpluses to recycle, but if we can recycle other people's surpluses, then we can remain hegemonic. And what they did then was the real genius stroke was where it is a lot of the deficits and surpluses, particularly then, but still now, are centered around energy markets when you look at what's happening. And so by tying the dollar to the energy markets, you ensure the U.S.'s ability to recycle recycle other people's surpluses. And that's what began to happen. You began to, what we've called, the dollar began to be pseudo-pegged to oil, where you can see it, the dollar was kept as good as gold for oil. It still encouraged the holding of dollar reserves, because dollar reserves were seen over time from, call it, 1973 to 2005, they were relatively consistent in terms of the value of oil. Oil traded between, most of the time, between $15 and $30 a barrel, $15, $25 a barrel. And when it got to 30, the U.S. Fed would be raising rates to slow the economy, and vice versa when it got to the bottom of that range. And so as a holder of dollar reserves, once again, you might not have loved that system, but you did have a degree of confidence that the dollars you held would buy you a relatively constant amount of energy over time, which is critical. That's basically what gold does for you as a reserve. So that's why I say the dollar was kept as good as gold for oil, effectively. And that system worked well enough for the big creditors of the system, which at the time were primarily the West Germans and the Japanese.
The idea of a reserve currency from a sovereign point of view is that you can, you know, stock it for later, right? You can use it as a piggy bank. It's basically you can buy stuff with it in the future. When you talk about surpluses and deficits, you're talking about trade or budget surplus.
I'm talking about just current account. I'm looking at the current account. So this combination of trade and budget.
Okay. So Kissinger, I mean, there isn't, as far as I know, there isn't a single event in monetary history since at least 1960 where Kissinger wasn't involved. he's still you know, alive and rocking. So we can get him on the podcast and talk about the events that are happening right now. But so we have this petrodollar system, right? Is that still in play today?
I would say there are echoes of it today. If you look at, obviously, alongside this, you had this euro dollar system, and ultimately the euro dollar system was, these petrodollar flows were being recycled into the euro dollar system, right?
And the euro dollar has nothing to do with the euro, right?
It's just offshore dollar balances dollars held off outside the United States. So
it's banks outside of the United States basically printing dollars, giving them out as loans to companies, whatever.
Correct. Yeah. It's you're creating dollar balances via dollar loans outside the US. And the only one that can actually print the physical dollar, the base money dollars, not the physical dollars, but the base money dollars to cover that currency short that is created when you take out a loan, is the Fed. So it creates this mismatch. Now, there are physical base money effectively being created by virtue of the petro in early days, substantial amounts of reserves being recycled into that system. But so is it still in place today? No, it's not in place because the U.S. was unable to sort of maintain that pseudo peg after 2005. So once oil goes 30, 40, 50, 60, due to a combination of geological reality, where we were running into a time of peak cheap energy, a surprisingly small amount of the world's oil, a surprisingly large amount of the world's oil comes from a surprisingly small number of super giant oil fields and giant oil fields. And those super giants and giant oil fields, to borrow Matt Simmons's phraseology, they were getting very old then. They're now 20 years older even. And so most, if not all, oil fields in history have followed a pretty predictable curve, Hubbard's curve, where you tap the well, production increases, it peaks, and then it rolls over in some way, shape, or form. And they all resemble a bell curve of some varying degree of steepness, depending on geology and production decisions, et cetera. So you have geology, which starts to strain this system, this 30-year system of keeping the dollar as good as gold for oil. You have the rise of China straining this system, where all of a sudden, by 2015, 2016, I would say, maybe even, China's the biggest oil importer in the world, surpassing the United States. But this whole time, you have this relentless bid for oil into a time where oil supplies are getting at least much more expensive to get, if not declining, in some big fields. And then you have, so these two factors make it very difficult for the U.S. to maintain that pseudo peg. And as oil goes 30, 40, 50, the U.S. should have been raising rates dramatically to basically bring oil back down. The problem is the U.S.'s domestic political and economic situation didn't allow it because we had a housing bubble. It had already burst in 05. So now you're into this dilemma where the U.S. needed to be raising rates to constrain energy inflation. But in terms of the dollar, the petrodollar system, if you will, this dollar pseudo peg that had existed for 30 years, at the same time, it needed to be lowering rates to contain the fallout and the contagion from the U.S.-centric dollar or housing bubble that had begun to burst. And it came to a head in the financial crisis. The U.S. faced a choice, either really tighten rates or really loosen rates. And we managed, instead of managing the dollar for the good of the world like we did in 1980, where we raised rates and put the U.S. into a severe recession to maintain the dollar's utility for the world as a reserve, as the primary reserve currency, we went in the opposite direction. We cut rates dramatically. We went to QE. And we managed the dollar for the good of America and sort of left the rest of the world's purchasing power, be a casualty of that. Now, it's important because I think up until that point, I think Europeans knew push came to shove. We would choose ourselves over Europe. I think that's part of the creation of the euro, and we can touch on that.
Because we do it the other way around. If when push comes to shove, we do choose the U.S. over Europe.
yeah, we choose U.S. over Europe, and so do you. Yeah, right.
It's... Yes, exactly.
Yes. For now, I'm not so sure Europe isn't playing both sides or doing, making a short term tactical decision vis-a-vis recent events, while also making a strategic long term decision in the eastern direction. I think is what we're watching happen in real time. But so. I think the Asian creditors in particular and China were under the misapprehension that if push came to shove, the Americans would choose to manage the dollar to preserve the energy purchasing power of Chinese reserves. And when push came to shove, the U.S. did not. The U.S. actually managed the dollar to hurt the purchasing power of Chinese reserves relative to energy in order to preserve the domestic U.S. economy. And so you began to see a shift immediately after the 2008 crisis, where the head of the PBOC, Zhao, had a three-page paper, white paper with the BIS, calling for a new currency system, calling for a neutral reserve asset. So bringing us right back to a version of what Keynes discussed in 1944. And in fact, Zhao specifically cited Keynes and the Bancor in that paper and saying that in light of all of the crises that had evolved under the American system, that history has shown that the Keynes system was a better option and one we should pursue.
But this is not the first time that somebody has been talking about a system like that. The so-called special drawing rights, they were set up in order to, make this Keynes idea in a reality as a reaction to the Triffin dilemma in the 1960s. And then the Europeans were all about the special drawing rights for a while. And then the Americans never, let it happen. And the Chinese talk about it in 2009, but nothing ever happens. The IMF gets reformed, but not in a way that anything would ever actually change. So why is that? I mean, why would the Americans never go this step that would, help them as well, possibly?
Because as a political culture, Americans never look more than 2 years ahead to the next election cycle. I think politically, dogmatically, hubristically, a number of American politicians just equate the dollar system to America, to their political power, America's power. And so it's simply not able to be discussed. I think Washington has arguably been by far the biggest winner against everybody else in the world, including other Americans, has been the biggest winner from this dollar system. And so you can see, you know, there was an article 10 years ago in the Washington Post noting that 7 of the 10 most affluent counties in America are around Washington, D.C. Well, what's Washington, D.C. make? They make nothing. They export treasuries and they make legislation. They don't produce really anything on a net basis for certain. And so why are they getting rich? They're getting rich because they are the center of the dollar and treasury export business. But it doesn't work out for the rest of the productive part of America. And that's why I think is this system is ultimately starting to break down, is the U.S. would not let, you know, it's almost like a monetary version of what John F. Kennedy, I think, once said, right? Those who would make evolution impossible make revolution inevitable. That's what we're watching in the currency system, is the U.S. on its own and then via the IMF made currency system evolution impossible. And so I think we're living through currency system revolution in very early days. And that revolution is being led by China and Russia, who are looking at the system knowing that it results in them having currency crises, and the Europeans as well, right? When you have men like Martin Selmayr calling for, you know, describing why the euro was founded and tying it back to the Nixon 1971 closing of the gold window. These nations and regions that are trade creditors, current account creditors, but energy debtors, understand that if this system isn't changed, then when the United States prints the $100 to $200 trillion for its baby boomers, we are going to significantly inflate the price of oil in dollars. The dollar reserves held by these nations and regions will run out, and then they will have currency crises and economic collapses. And that is simply not, it's not a policy option. And so I think that is the reality driving the changes we have seen since 08. It drove, I think, the PBOC and Zhao to say we need a new system. And you saw the Chinese in particular begin working on this. And a linchpin to this is them gaining the ability to buy currency in Chinese yuan, to be able to print yuan for oil.
There's one very important point here, because this is the same thing that happened with the Europeans. And before we get to what's happening today, I want to start with the euro, because the Europeans were saying, let's reform the system, let's use the IMF, let's use the SDR. They failed to set up the euro. Now the Chinese have been saying this in 2009, but I don't think that they actually expected the Americans to say, okay, let's do it. They just wanted to, on paper, that they tried. Just like it's a strategy that the Russians also been using for years now, trying and failing and then saying, okay, we tried. Can you talk about the significance of the euro in this whole system? What's the special role that the euro is playing? Because it is the second biggest reserve currency.
I think, to me, I look at the euro and I think the euro was set up and structured to be attractive to Arab oil exporters and Russian oil exporters, you know, to Russia. And what I mean by that is the dollar system, as Secretary of the Treasury John Connolly famously said, it's our currency, but it's your problem. Which is to say, we're going to print whatever we're going to print, and you deal with it. You deal with the inflation. We're going to export that inflation. The euro, when it was constructed, surprised everybody when the European Central Bank put 15% of Eurozone reserves into gold, mark-to-market quarterly. Because, you know, in the late 90s, I mean, as gold was just completely irrelevant as an asset. Everybody hated it. And consensus at the time was, oh, Europe loves the Americans. And that's, I think, still the consensus. And I'm not saying they don't, but I think it's more nuanced and complex than that when it comes to the monetary system. And what I mean by that is if Europe loved the American system, the dollar system, as much as American consensus thinks they do, they never would have put that 15% in reserves into gold, mark-to-market quarterly, the anti-dollar. They would have just put that 15% into treasury reserves like everybody else and tied themselves to the dollar, and that would have been it. But instead, what's that? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but by marking to market it quarterly, they profit basically from a rise in price. So gold gets more important, and gold starts rising in price in 1999, 2000, when the euro started.
Yep. And it makes the euro, the treatment of gold, the inclusion of gold and the treatment of gold, that marking to market, is an expression, if you have the eyes to see it, that the euro is, it's our currency and it's our problem. In other words, if when the eurozone starts to print money for whatever crisis came down the line, which inevitably it did, it's a political system, then the creditors holding euro balances can see that the price of gold is going to be allowed to rise in euro terms, that the gold is going to serve as a ballast for the currency. And so I think that was done in a nod, because when you think about who is going to end up with euro balances as a reserve currency, you have to run surpluses against the eurozone. Who runs surpluses against the eurozone? Russia and the Middle East, it's energy and commodity suppliers. And gold has always been very attractive to Middle East Arab oil exporters and to the Russians. And so I think the construction of the euro was an expression of, it's our currency and it's our problem, designed to get oil exporters to begin selling oil in euros. And they did. Saddam Hussein came out in October of 2000. And in nominally, at least, due to sanctions that the U.S. had continued to impose on him, switched his invoicing and his settlement from dollars to euros. He was 5% of the oil market at that time, which is more than enough. Again, in commodities, the marginal ton price is the whole. So in 2000, the marginal ton of oil globally began to be priced in euros. And it was a big deal. And I think is where the euro factors into all of this, which is they made all the moves to try to start moving away from this system that this post-71 system. And I think the eurozone, broadly speaking, was surprised, that war interrupted this, that interrupted that process.
So that now we are in the year 2022. Russia attacks the Ukraine. There are horrible things happening, atrocities, war crimes. We don't really know, but we see and we suffer with the people. It's horrible. We're very close here in Vienna. We have refugees all over the city. And those are the lucky ones. They got out, right? It seems like everything that has been worked towards in the last decades has broken down. Russia has gotten rid of their dollar reserves for years, and they switched to the euro. In 2010, Putin even said that Russia might join the euro one day. It was tongue in cheek, but he said it. And now Russia is saying, well, the euro is worthless to us, because the European side, together with the Americans, they froze their reserves. So what is happening, Luke?
Yeah, I think your phrase, they defaulted on reserves, is the right language, which is we've gone from, okay, Americans default on gold reserves to Americans. Americans default on gold reserves to the rest of the world. Americans default on the petrodollar pseudo-peg, dollar gold pseudo-peg. And now Americans and Europeans default on FX reserves. And when I say default, is you referred to them as being a piggy bank, and that's, I think, the right way. These are simply the result of past economic surplus, past economic activity. These are the savings instrument. And so to the extent they were weaponized, it opened a Pandora's box for creditor regions that could be named bad actors in the future. And everybody, over the last 50 to 70 years, everybody's been a bad actor at one point in time in the Americans' eyes, and in really any nation's eyes. That's simply the nature of global geopolitics. So now we're into this area where what is going to be, where imbalances are going to occur. They tend to occur around energy and commodity trade. What are the surpluses around and deficits around those imbalances going to be settled in? And knowing that that FX reserves are no longer safe from political sanction or seizure, I think it actually is a trip back to the future, is what we're seeing, which is if you don't hold it, you don't own it. And if you don't hold it, you don't own it. There's really only a couple reserve assets, you know, that I think are of use. I think gold, number one. I think Bitcoin at some point could serve that some of that role as well. And then I think, you know, Zoltan Pozsar at Credit Suisse has been very vocal about this, that you'll see an increasing reserving of commodities and commodity assets. Now, what's interesting is this is effectively but what Russia and the Chinese have been doing really since 2008 and certainly since 2013. You alluded to Russia getting rid of their dollar reserves. They've been buying lots of gold since 2008, most of it stockpiled in Russia itself. But the Chinese have been very clearly favoring finite hard assets. You can Google China buys blank and you'll find it's gold, it's copper mines, it's oil fields, it's farmland, it's, you know, the port of Piraeus in Greece. And then lending dollars out along the Belt and Road. So they earn dollars, they earn a spread on their dollars. And a lot of times these loans are collateralized further by hard assets. And so, or commodity production, you know, streams, right? So there's, you know, it was an article in 2013 that China had monopolized Ecuador's oil. They lent them dollars and they took payment in oil barrels. And that there was a model that has been happening all over. So it's interesting that we're now reaching this point where you have someone as esteemed as Zoltan Pozsar at Credit Suisse calling this Bretton Woods 3, this new system where FX reserves are no longer of value because they can be sanctioned or seized at any time. And so what is of value is gold, Bitcoin, commodities. That's exactly where Russia and China have been for the last 10 years.
I mean, calling it Bretton Woods 3 is actually very wrong. Because Bretton Woods was the first and only, you know, monetary system that has ever come into existence by agreement. And there is no agreement. There hasn't been an agreement for Bretton Woods 2. So it doesn't really work like that. But okay, I mean, he's obviously smarter than I am. But so what's the situation regarding Europe right now? What do you think? I mean, what's the options here? Because we have been clear and of course, we don't really have a choice, right? I mean, with the sanctions and everything, Russia, it seems like Russia is telling Europe that we have to decide between the two sides. This is what it seems like. And so far, we have decided to go with the so-called West, with the Americans. But is that a long-term strategy that could work out?
In my opinion, no, it's not. I think Europe is right now, in my view, playing a very, very dangerous game, which is to say, we've seen this movie before in Europe, where you cut your energy exports and then you print money over top of it to try to offset the resulting economic weakness. Because let's back up. Europe can't afford a recession. The US can't afford a recession. Where the sovereign debt is, where the obligations are, where the banking system is in Europe, you can't afford a recession. This system will come under quite a bit of pressure. So if we start as that as our point, and I think this factored into Putin's calculations, which is neither the Europe nor the Americans can afford a recession. And neither Europe nor the Americans can afford the world without Russian energy because energy prices will skyrocket. And so the policymakers that have allowed this system in the US and in Europe to evolve, this situation to evolve over the last 20 years, it is what it is. If given the fiscal and debt situation of Europe, we've seen this before. We saw this after World War I. Where the French and the Belgians came in and seized the Ruhr Valley coal stores as war payment reparations from the Germans. And the Germans said, uh-oh, you know, the economy's slowing, let's just print money. When you print money after removing a chunk of your energy, it doesn't end up well. Your energy costs skyrocket and you go into a spiral. And that's why I say the Europeans, I think, are playing a very, very dangerous game where I saw last week, and I don't know the internal politics of Europe well enough to know how credible this is, but European Parliament, large numbers of them are calling for a complete embargo of Russian energy in Europe, which, okay, but, and then you have members of the ECB, Lane, I think it was, calling for a fiscal response if the economy worsens. Well, if you remove Russian energy, I assure you, I guarantee you, you're going to have a recession. There's no question. You're probably already in one. If you then...
Even if we don't remove Russian energy, I mean, how are we not going to have a recession with the war going on in Ukraine and all the sanctions that are already in place?
Absolutely. And then if you print money on top of that, you're going to have a severely inflationary recession. And you know, I think the election in France is you know, Macron from at least last night won from what I could tell, but he didn't win by a lot. And I think that's just an advance look at where politics will go in Europe, in the U.S. over the next couple of years if we keep this up, which is, well, if you have an inflationary recession.
Macron and Scholz are absolutely at least playing both sides. I mean,
I agree, even if
he wins, it's still you know, the strategic interests are there and you can't change them. And all this started with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. There was a German project as much as it was a Russian project.
I devolved into the politics a bit, which I didn't mean to do. So to your question, where I think the Europeans, so I think in the very short run, embargoing Russian energy, I think is economic suicide, effectively. Yes. But I think there is intense political pressure from the legacy relationships with America and to a lesser extent the UK, to virtue signal that they're going to do that. I also think, as you said, with France, I think definitely with Germany, I think they both recognize, and I think throughout much of the continent, I think they recognize their economic future is east, not west. And so I think it's this trying to balance these two realities and these two different timeframes of the political realities of now, which is we need to placate the Americans and show that we're doing our part in terms of going after, you know, Louis Gav at GavCal, I thought had a very harsh but poignant and accurate quote, which is the Americans will fight the Russians down to the last European. Right. And I think that's what we're watching in real time, at least hopefully just from an economic perspective, primarily. And I hope that's where it stays. But that summarizes the situation, I think, very well. And so in the short run, that is sort of the governor on the political situation and the economic situation for Europe is we need to sort of keep these political ties with the U.S. Once you get out from the very near term, I don't see how Europe needs Russian energy. I don't see that changing. And critically, I think they're going to have to make that decision because every day that passes, Russia has severe costs. Ukraine has the most severe costs. Europe has severe costs. But also every day that passes on the other side, you're going to get closer to Russia being able to redirect that energy away from you toward China. And ultimately, if you use more expensive American energy while the Chinese are using cheaper Russian energy, German and European industry will be handicapped vis-a-vis its energy costs relative to China. It will be separated from Russia and China in some way, form, shape, or form. And that's where the future growth for European industry needs to be. It's where it has to be. So we're sort of in between two trapezes, if you will, where we're, you know, I think Europe is still holding on economically and politically to the American trapeze, and it needs to be grabbing, you know, the eastward trapeze in terms of the future growth for the next 10 to 20 years for European industry. But for the moment, it's not doing so.
It's really hard because you're talking about economics, but politically, I mean, obviously you don't want to be aligned with Putin, and you also don't want to be aligned with the Chinese, who are completely insane. I mean, the Americans, you know, they might plan 2 years ahead, right? But at least they have this liberal democracy system with checks and balances, and another communist dictatorship. That's a real moral problem here.
Yeah, and that's it's right. So do you want a system where, you know, who do you partner with? Do you partner with the U.S. where we have that neoliberal system, or that the more liberal political system, more closely aligned historically with the European view, but which we will also take away all your savings if you don't play ball, and which we will interrupt any attempts on your part to gain independence from us by, you know, invading countries in the Middle East, selling oil in your currency and switching it back to our currency, etc.? Or do you go with the Chinese, who are, like you said, authoritarian, but pragmatic to an extreme? I mean, extremely pragmatic, right? I mean, for us, we are very open and liberal, but we also attach, 16 political conditions to economic decisions. And the Chinese are like, well, it's just all about the economics, and to hell with anything else. We just want to make money. And even if that results in any number of human rights violations, et cetera, but that's where much more growth is going to be. So it's a very difficult situation for Europe to be in.
You can think about her and her decisions over 12 years, what you want, but nothing like this would be happening if Angela Merkel didn't retire. You know, she was the linchpin that held it all together. And the minute she was out of office, everything started to break down.
And I think, I think that, and I think also, Biden in the U.S., I think is...
Ironically, because all we heard is Trump is the problem.
Yeah, and that's, it's, Trump was the problem, without getting into the U.S. politics of it too much, I think ultimately,
I mean, one of the problems here in Europe, especially in Germany and Austria, I can't talk too much about France or Spain or Italy, is that there is no national discourse about, the national interests of your own country or of Europe. There's just none. Nobody talks about it. I'm sure in Russia they talk about it. I'm sure in China and the US they talk about it. But in Europe, it's all external, You always think about what do others think about you. And then, of course, the politicians, they still need to do what they do, but it's even harder because there's no support in the arena in the media. The petrodollar was based on this deal with the Saudis, and the Saudis, there were no friends of the US before this deal was brokered. Were they ever friends of the US, like real friends, or was it all just about the money?
What do you mean? When what deal broke? What do you mean?
Yeah, the 73 deal, 74 deal, the petrodollar deal. The Saudis and the US, they were not enemies, but they were also not friends, right? And now they don't seem to be very good friends.
Yeah, I think FDR signed a deal with I guess it would have been King Saud back in the 30s or 40s, and he promised to give them gold for every barrel they took out of his country. Eisenhower. Part of his logic was in the Suez Crisis, in coming down on the British, was how could I support the UK and in so doing lose the entire Arab world? And so I think there was a relationship there. I think to your point, it became much more important in the 70s around the petrodollar and much closer. And I think, I think you're right that the relationship between the U.S. and the Saudis was increasingly strained under Obama. I think it mended somewhat under Trump. And then I think it is completely, I don't want to say fallen apart, but it has gotten much worse under the Biden administration.
Biden doesn't even talk to Mohammed bin Salman, right? He said he's only talking to the king. And then he tried calling him and Mohammed didn't pick up. That happened.
No, my understanding is that the Saudis and that predates the Russian crisis. I heard last summer the Saudis had no interest in talking to the American. The Americans wanted to stop and say hello, and while they were in the region, and
that's not looking too good.
That the Saudis said, yeah, we'd love to have you, and what do you want to talk about? And at the end of the day, I think it was they said, now pass, go back home. And so, yeah, I think the relationship between the U.S. and the Saudis is probably as strained as it's been in a long time. And I think some of that has to do with Iran. And I'm not an expert in all these, you know, I just know what I've been hearing credible rumblings of, like what I just mentioned. I think some of it's around Iran. I think at the end of the day, I think the Saudis just want stability. I think they want stability. And I think that they're not seeing a lot of it from the American side.
If we go back to 1944, this main issue, the main problem of using the dollar as a world reserve currency, it's not only like advantageous, it's not only a good thing for the Americans, right? You know, your manufacturing has been going to China, right?
Mm-hmm.
So because it's much easier to just print money and buy stuff than to actually build stuff. And there is an exception with all the digital stuff like Apple and Google, that brought the US economy back to an extent. But is there a solution to this? And how could it look like? Is it the SDR? Is it gold? Is it Bitcoin? Because in the end, we're looking for a neutral reserve asset, right? That has rules that cannot be changed so easily and not politically.
The solution to the problem is very simple, and that is you peg a neutral reserve asset to energy at a fixed rate, right? So you say you do a one-time revaluation of gold against oil to simplify. You could use Bitcoin, but gold is worth 100 barrels an ounce, 200 barrels an ounce, 1,000 barrels an ounce, whatever. And then you have to that decentralizes the energy policy to each country. Because under the dollar system, America's in charge of everybody's energy policy, right? Through the dollar. We print a bunch of money, the Fed raises rates, right? Like everyone's energy policy is a derivative of the US and the Fed. If you peg energy to gold, right? The US pegged the dollar to gold and that broke apart. And then the US pseudo-pegged the dollar to energy and that broke apart. The fix is pegging gold to oil at a high enough rate where you now have energy or gold is explicitly, the neutral reserve asset is explicitly a value of energy. And now every region can make their own energy policy. So the Americans have, at the high enough price of oil, a lot of oil. And that's something we like to have for national security reasons. Okay, we have a high price of oil. That means we have a high price of gold. The Europeans don't have a lot of natural reserves at any price for oil, so they need a low price of oil to feed into their production machine, their export machine, and so they need a low price of gold. And so this does away with two things. So if you have a low price of gold in Europe, you have a high price of gold in America through the gold link, the euro will be much stronger against the dollar. By virtue of each nation's energy policy, it will be a balance of payments driven relative currency valuations. It will do away with both the dollar's exorbitant privilege and the hollowing out of American manufacturing. It will also force the Europeans and the Chinese and the Japanese out of mercantile-like policies where they benefit from, you know, the system on the export side. And so it'll force the Europeans and the Chinese and the Japanese to consume a lot more of their own production. It'll force the Americans to produce a lot more of their own consumption. And it's very simple to mandate. It's like I said, you just peg a unit of energy to a unit of gold or Bitcoin or something, and away you go. Now, politically, it is not very simple. It's incredibly difficult politically. So that's ultimately the fix. Now, interestingly, as we talked about earlier, is Washington has generally benefited from this arrangement. There's increasingly, particularly post-COVID, a new school of thought of this, which is we're not benefiting from this. The dollar system as structured has deindustrialized us so much that it's now a national security risk. And this is something the U.S. military has been saying for over a decade. You can't tell us that China is our big strategic competitor and potential threat and then expect us to source our war machine from China. It's stupid. And in Washington, like I said, the U.S. Department of Defense has been saying this for over a decade. Until COVID, though, nobody in Washington was listening. Once Washington said, "Ooh, we need masks," and the Chinese said, "Hold on, you'll get your masks after we get our masks," then it became obvious to even the most rabid, you know, post-$71 system proponents that there was a problem with this system. And it really just comes down to military guys or supply chain guys at the end. You know, wars are about logistics. You have logistics, you win. You don't, you lose. And the military guy's been saying for a decade, this dollar system that has hollowed out our manufacturing has led us unable to fight a war without China, which is a problem because we might be fighting China. And so I think that's where we are in terms of a potential catalyst for this system to migrate from this post-$71 system to this system with a neutral reserve asset.
And it needs to be, it needs to look like, for the US to do it, it needs to look like there's something that they do out of strength, right?
I think
so. How do you get there? How do you, what are the steps you are looking for? What's happening in the US right now? Is anybody talking about this?
Short answer is no. American media is really interesting because it I don't know how this is in other countries, but Americans focus on whatever the media tells them to focus on. So for, you know, 2020 through, you know, 6 weeks ago, it was all COVID all the time. And now it's all Ukraine all the time. You know, COVID's dead. So nobody's talking about the FX reserve things. You know, when you, to answer your question directly, if I wanted to give the system a shove in this direction while making it look like it was happening from a position of strength, I would sanction Russian FX reserves. You know, I would default on it. Makes us look very strong. Look at that. We're punishing Putin. We're punishing Russia. Look at us. While at the same time, we are completely discrediting FX reserves as a reserve asset going forward. Anybody who puts money in FX reserves now, we'll seize them. You do the wrong thing. Look, listen to what Biden said about Prince MBS on the campaign trail. He called him a murderer. He said that Saudi Arabia as a state has no reason to exist. You think they want to hold dollar reserves?
Probably not. I don't know.
Now, American politics are very unique in that, I don't know if they're very unique, but one unique thing about it, one interesting thing about American politics is, to win the American nomination, you have to cater to the extremes in both parties, right? So when you're on the campaign trail as a Democrat, you have to say all these crazy left things. And then once you win the nomination, veer back to the middle. And similarly, for the Republicans, you have to say all these crazy right things and then veer back to the middle for the national election. And so this was on the campaign trail. So I don't know that you can take Biden's words at face value. But again, it all depends. Who's a bad actor? Saudi was a bad actor after the Khashoggi incident. The Germans were bad actors in the 70s for trying to get their gold back. The French were bad actors in the 60s for trying to get their gold back. The Belgians, the Dutch in the 60s. The British were bad actors in the 50s with the Suez crisis. The Japanese were bad actors in the 80s. We've just told you, if you're a bad actor, we'll take your money. We'll take your FX reserves. And so if I was an American policymaker that was particularly Machiavellian, and I do think those types of people still exist. I don't think they are the frontline people or even the frontline people's frontline advisors, but I think they absolutely exist in positions of power in Washington. I think a masterstroke. We need to move this system towards one with a neutral currency, a neutral reserve asset, in a way that makes us look like we're doing it out of a position of strength. How do we do that? Sanction Russian FX reserves. Take it. Take the money. Dissuade anybody from putting marginal money into FX reserves. That will weaken the dollar over time. It will increase gold's price over time. It will build organically a neutral reserve asset that will allow us to start reshoring production here. It checks a lot of boxes.
But that would be, I mean, that would explain why the Europeans are doing the same, right? Because we do have the gold. We don't have to worry about the gold price so much. So we can sanction euros reserves as well. That's what we're doing right now.
I think that's right. I think it could very well be the case that they're going along with this. I mean, really, you would think if you were going to do this and the Europeans sat down with the Americans again, I may be ascribing a level of Machiavellianism as too high for both the U.S. and Europeans, but let's just game it out. U.S. does this and the Europeans don't do this. The euro is going to gain a whole bunch of share relative to the dollar. You'll see all of the reserves flow into euros, and that may that sends the euro up in value, reduces euro competitiveness, not necessarily the goals of what the Europeans are trying to do. If the Europeans sanction euro reserves at the same time as the U.S. does, to me, the message is very clear. Buy gold. The only place you can take this money is gold. And now, the Europeans want gold back in the system anyway, as a neutral reserve asset. That's been their goal all along. So to me, yeah, I think it's potentially very Machiavellian from the European side for two reasons. Number one, it prevents dollar reserve. It gives the American policymakers the nod they need. Hey, the Europeans are with us. Number two, it prevents the strengthening of the euro as people will go from dollars into euros if the Europeans didn't and the Americans did. And number three, it forces reserves into gold, which is what the Europeans have been wanting for 50 years.
But that would mean the Europeans are in the driving seat when it comes to the US-European relationship, or that the Europeans are working with somebody within the American administration who want the same thing, maybe the military. So what you're saying is here, if I understand you correctly, that regardless of all the politics and even the war, that actually the outcome that the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, and the Americans want is the same. Taking down the paper system, so to say, and replacing it with a gold-based system. Or at least some fraction within those and they're basically using the Ukraine for that.
There's precedent for that, right? You go back to the Yom Kippur War in 73. They went into that war and oil was 3. They exited that war 4 months later and oil was 12. And oil was big enough to back the dollar, effectively. And you can read, you know, Sheikh Yamani wrote and has given interviews since, right? The Saudi oil minister at the time. When he went to the Shah of Iran and said, why are you raising oil prices? Why are you quadrupling oil prices? The Shah of Iran said, I don't know. Go talk to Henry Kissinger. Right? So there was... there's precedent for wars being the genesis of changes to the monetary system. Obviously, World War II, a much bigger conflict, was the genesis of where we are here. So, yeah, that is what I'm saying. Is not that that's why this war is happening. It's not even that this is happening again in terms of a war being the cover. I'm saying could be, but what I am saying is that we know what the Russians want. They've been very clear. Away from the political goals in terms of the buffer countries, et cetera, which they've been very clear about, they have been buying a lot of gold and not buying a lot of dollars. They want oil priced in multiple currencies. They want Washington not to control the effective price of their output. The Chinese are on the opposite side of that same coin, which is they don't want Washington in control of the price of their critical commodity imports. Same goal. In terms of what that implies for the evolution of the monetary system. The Europeans have been very vocal, as we noted, dating back to the 70s, where they were looking at settling oil deficits with the Arabs in gold at a market price, a free, you know, the free gold price. And we can see that in the U.S. archives, discussing that in 73, 74, et cetera. And then again with the gold treatment in the Eurozone in 99. And then again in 2019 when the central bank gold agreement of European central banks, they did away with it first time in 20 years. We have no plans to sell any more gold. The gold repatriations before that. And then...
Yeah, we got it home. We got it home in 2015.
You've got it all home.
Not all. Half of
it. Yeah. What you need, right? What you need. And, yeah. and for the Americans, for the first time, the military's been talking about it for 10 years. Trump was a function of this currency system. I mean, this is just middle America has been too deindustrialized. The middle class has been too hollowed out by this system. And I don't think they cared to listen to the military. They being the sort of the dollar politicians, if you will. I don't think they cared what the military said. I don't think they cared what Trump said, what the message of Trump was, until they couldn't get their own masks. And once Washington couldn't get its own masks, then it was an aha moment. In 2020, oh my gosh, we're dependent on the Chinese, and the guys at the U.S. military had to have gone, you know, yeah, we're dependent on the Chinese. Now run that all. So for the first time in 70 years, you have a quorum of major political actors in Asia, Russia, Europe, Middle East, US, all have an interest in this system migrating towards something with a neutral reserve asset. And I think de facto that's gold for the time being. Could it be SDR bonds at some point in the future? Maybe. You know, I think that's less and less likely by the day, given the global fracturing we're seeing. Could it be Bitcoin at some point in the future? Yes, maybe. I think gold will always have a role within that, because the reality is, if the U.S. sent up, you know, if the U.S. or another either nation state or terrorist state set off an EMP, you know, the Bitcoin is impaired for some period of time, potentially. The gold will just be sitting there.
Well, the gold would also be impaired. You can't do anything with it if you set off an EMP. That's true. But in the head of the people, it at least it's still there. You know, you can't.
Right. That's a good point.
And also the gold is already in play, right? It's already within the reserves of the governments and the central banks.
Yes.
But I mean, as you know, to sum this up, can we speculate a bit on Bitcoin's role? Because
sure.
It seems to me that it does have lots of in its nature, it's a neutral reserve asset, right? It's mm-hmm. it is what the SDR and the euro are on paper, but not in reality, because in reality it's still political. It still just gets printed. In my eyes, when you look at it right now, Bitcoin plays much more of a role for the everyday people, you know, you and me, like Ukrainians on the street, Russians on the street, Europeans, Americans, South Americans, than it does for countries. But I think that that's a very important role, especially in these very, very, challenging times.
I'm sorry, you said Bitcoin plays more of a role day to day. Is that what you, I missed that part.
Yeah, for people. It plays more of a role as a reserve asset, as an alternative reserve asset for young people, so mm-hmm. to say. Than for governments or nation states.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's, you know, I've called it the reserve asset for the people, and I think it's how you're seeing the system evolve organically, which is gold is being held as a reserve asset for nation states and Bitcoin for people. I think that's exactly right, and I think it could continue to evolve where it becomes one for nation states as well. There's a bit of a game theory attached to it where if you have a major nation state do that. Start to reserve Bitcoin, that becomes a really interesting situation, because just given the relative scarcity, et cetera, that would allow a nation to gain an advantage over a nation that was holding just purely gold. And so the question is, you know, it becomes if gold is a nuclear weapon of currency war, Bitcoin in the hands of a sovereign has the potential to be a megaton hydrogen bomb of currency war.
I mean, the game theory would state that you start accumulating it, maybe even mining it, but you don't tell anyone about it, right?
I think that's
so,
right.
So we really don't know if there is sovereigns or governments or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point, because you got to believe that there are people that understand this. I mean, I know on the American side there are. I don't know that there are that many, but there are.
So what do you think is going to happen next? Maybe even like looking at, you know, people want to know what to do, right? Where to put their money, what to do with regard to the markets. What do you believe we're going to see within the next 12 months?
I think we're heading into a really rough time, because as I look around the world, I see the U.S. attempting to commit economic suicide by tightening policy. So you're seeing, you know, stocks down, bond yields up. That's what economic suicide looks like in the U.S. I see the Europeans attempting to commit economic suicide, which is embargo energy and print money. I see the Chinese attempting to commit economic suicide for themselves and the world via supply chains and these lockdowns. I see the war creating severe collateral damage. The war itself is a tragic situation, and we're going to see more tragic situations around emerging markets. I think we're starting to see that in terms of famine, food shortages, riots, etc. And Ultimately, is a situation. These are situations that central banks will only make worse by printing money. And so you're seeing this deglobalization, this interruption of various different supply chains all at once. And so it leads, I think it leads to a few conclusions in terms of where you put your money. I think volatility is going up. I think you want to own stuff with no counterparty risk, right? So gold, Bitcoin. I think you want to probably own commodities still, particularly those tied to agriculture, metals, energy. And then I think you want to own probably unique pieces of real estate, things that are not easily replicable in places with good rule of law. I think you want to have probably a lot of, an overweight cash position. And I think that cash, for me, if I was, I'm an American, I hold dollars. If I was a European, I'd probably hold some in euros. I'd probably hold some in Swiss francs. And because unless we get a very big de-escalation in weeks, a month, maybe 2 months might be the most we have. The level of chaos that I think we're setting up for is pretty great, unfortunately. And it doesn't give me any joy to say that, but I'm just looking at these disruptions. Any one of these disruptions would be problematic in a system as levered as ours is. All of them together feeding back, feeding back on each other in a system as levered as ours has the potential to be really catastrophic.
Is there a real danger in the West, in the US, and in Europe of hyperinflation? Because Jack Dorsey was tweeting about it. Michael Burry was tweeting about it. Then he was, they had to delete his account. Jack Dorsey doesn't have to delete his Twitter account, unfortunately. And a week back, Markus Söder, the minister president of Bavaria, actually used the word hyperinflation on television. And then I thought he was like, he was just, it's in his head, but he doesn't really mean it. And then he tweeted about it, so he does mean it.
So hyperinflation this time will be a really weird thing, because what you're going to get, hyperinflation could very well be defined as deflation, X energy and food, right? Hyperinflations are about energy and food prices skyrocketing, necessities skyrocketing, and leaving no money for anything else. But if you look at it, how our economic data is reported to us, X food and energy, core CPI, it'll be X food and energy in a hyperinflation in the West, core CPI will collapse. So that observation aside, is it possible? I think if you look at the formulas of hyperinflations, I think it's largely a psychological phenomenon taking place. And the psychological tipping point is hard to measure. That just happens. But you have prerequisites. Right. Prerequisite number one, high levels of debt, check. Prerequisite number two, high levels of deficits, check, in the U.S. Prerequisite number three is usually some type of war or supply chain disruption, check. I would argue COVID was a warlike supply chain disruption that is arguably ongoing now or reaccelerating. And now this Ukraine situation is the Russian invasion of Ukraine is making that even worse. Then you need sort of a political a lack of faith in the politicians. And I think we're in the early days of that in terms of the inflation and their inability to really do anything. I mean, they're throwing things against the wall, but the things they're throwing against the wall, at least here in the U.S., they're all inflationary. Hey, let's suspend the gasoline tax. Let's defer student loan repayments here in the U.S. They were supposed to start again in May. We just deferred them again. All of these things to sort of put more money into people's pockets. So you've got, it's like a tornado, right? Is the conditions for a tornado are set. Will we have a tornado? I don't know. If the Europeans try to totally embargo Russian energy, I don't know.
Print the money. Yeah.
And then print the money. You've got the recipe for a hyperinflation. Now, what does that look like? I tend to think it'll look more like a, and I think this is increasing. It's still not my base case, But for the U.S. and Europe, I think we should be spending a lot more time looking at Israel in the early 80s. I mean, Israel had 100 to 400% per year inflation for several years in a row. It's barely ever mentioned, right? If people talk about hyperinflation, and it's always, oh, Venezuela, Argentina, Weimar Germany.
This is the first time I hear this, and I've been dealing with this stuff for a while now. But this is the first time I hear this.
Yeah, you had massive deficits, and you know, and I think it's an important example because it goes to show you that you can have inflation run 100 to 400% in a developed country. They get rid of the debt, they raise rates, they normalize policy, and it's like it never happened. It's just bondholders get royally screwed. And I think that's still not my base case. But if that was a Seven Sigma event 3 years ago, and then 2 years ago it was a Three Sigma event, like today it's probably a Two Sigma event or 1.5 Sigma event.
And we talk about this so-called hyperinflation being a horrible thing, right? But in the end, it doesn't matter how we get there, but we will need, you said we're moving to gold, right? That's your case. You're saying basically that the system is going to move to gold at some point.
I think it has been moving to gold for 10, 12 years. I think the Westerners have just taken steps either by accident or by Machiavellian design to give the system a big shove in that direction. When the US and the EU suspended or sanctioned FX reserves.
Okay, because this is a really, really important takeaway from this talk, that it's not, quote unquote, just the Russians and the Chinese. It's actually the West giving them what they have always wanted by acting like they are fighting them, which is totally weird. But going back to the hyperinflation question, sometimes I feel like it's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. I mean, if you meet a 23-year-old who has bought the right, you know, JPEG of an ape, and is now a multimillionaire, he will never go work again for €1,000 a month. I mean, he already is through hyperinflation, right? And there's more people like that.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know. I think high inflation is here, and it's, yeah, you've had hyperinflation in certain assets, right? You've had, you know, when you read the stories of, you know, some of the great hyperinflations, there's of course the casino like nature of the markets, that nobody does anything productive. It's everyone becomes a speculator. You don't need to work because your stocks are going up so much, right? So there are
that shades, sounds very familiar.
All very familiar, right? So it's matters of degree. I think directionally we're moving that direction. I don't think it's a hyperinflation. I think it is, again, it's symptoms of the precondition of the tornado, right? Of the hyperinflation or of the Israeli type inflation, where you go through a span of several years of triple digit CPI inflation. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be currency killing hyperinflation. I think we're seeing symptoms of that. And I think that's what has the Fed so freaked out, which is we have to tighten. I think they are seeing symptoms of this. But this is the part that most Western investors are completely missing, which is these inflationary situations, these, it's not just a case of policy being too loose and there's a policy mistake. The key is that it's really the tinder and the kindling wood for this inflationary fire is government debt and government deficits. And what I mean by that is, you allow your debt and deficits to get so high, it's that the government cannot allow the free markets to set the borrowing rate for the government, and the central bank then effectively or explicitly caps those interest rates in order to allow the government to continue to afford to borrow. And we're there. Like, that's the thing that people, I find, by and large, still do not understand. U.S. debt to GDP at 125% and rising, and U.S. deficits at 10% of GDP at this point in the economic cycle, with unemployment as low as it is, and us still having tax receipts that are barely covering just our treasury spending and our entitlement paygoes. These are the tinder and kindling wood for an inflationary fire, because the U.S. government is not going to allow the bond market to defund it. Interest rates at some point are going to reach a point where the United States cannot afford treasury spending, entitlements, and defense. Those three items alone are 120% of tax receipts, with U.S. tax receipts at all-time highs and up enormously last year on the back of 12% nominal GDP inflated by 8% inflation. That was probably closer to 10% inflation. And it's that transition where it becomes obvious to everybody that QE isn't about stimulus and all this other crap they tell you. It's about making sure the U.S. government's borrowing rate is economically palatable, that you really get that aha psychological moment into some sort of high inflation situation. And I think every tick higher in the 10-year Treasury yield brings us closer to that moment. And I think that's why gold is rising with nominal rates doing what they're doing, why gold is rising with real rates doing what they're doing. Everybody's looking at gold and going, oh, I want to short gold. No, no, you shouldn't be. What gold's telling you is a sovereign debt crisis is coming in the United States of America, in Europe, where the central banks are going to have to say, that's it, free markets, you're done for a while. Here's the price of the treasury. And when that happens, inflation is going to go.
Okay. Look, we could go on for hours, maybe even days here, and I would love to, but I'll let you go on with your work. But one last question.
Sure.
Is there any chance to get through this with a S&P 500 index fund?
I think the S&P will probably actually do okay through this. Number one, the S&P will go down until that tipping point is reached of governments drawing the line on bond markets, just saying rates can't be allowed to go higher than this. And then I think the S&P will probably do fine, will probably keep up with inflation. But I think within the S&P 500 specifically, you'll see a vicious sector rotation where it's a very, very tech heavy index. I don't think tech will do that well in this environment relative to commodities and industrials, which I think will do very well in this environment. So I think you can do okay that way. For me, when I think about asset allocation in the situation that seems to be evolving and what I just described, right, where you have the US, Europe, China all committing economic suicide in one way or another, deglobalization, war, inflation, commodity supply difficulties, emerging market being the sort of the collateral damage, I think you have to think about this in terms of what I call the Jacob Fugger allocation, right? It was, I don't know, 1400s, 1500s, the wealthiest man to ever live by measure of the economy at the time. And he had an allocation where he was 25% cash, 25% stocks, 25% real estate, 25% gold. And he actually had 25% bonds. I think you want to own stocks over bonds over the course of this. And I think gold is effectively your gold and your bond portfolio. But across some measure of that, where you're broadly diversified and you balance out based on, because I just think there's nothing new under the sun in terms of history. It's just, it's been a long time since it's all happened at once like this, and it's never happened at this scale with debt this high, et cetera, with the derivatives, et cetera. So there's just, to me, I think the best way to play it is to be diversified in sort of that Jacob Fugger broadly diversified way, so that you can then rebalance depending on events. And that, I think from here, I don't think you'd want to be a hero. It's so political. There's so much political risk. The key is getting from here to the other side of the valley. And I think that is the type of asset allocation that will ensure you get your assets from here to the other side of the valley worth at least and probably more than what you started the valley with.
So great. Luke, I know you've been working on this for years, as have I. I started an English newsletter yesterday because I decided I have to add this to the conversation, because most of the real interesting conversation is globally. I want to do this. I'm doing this German podcast because I want to, translate everything for the German speaking community. It's a big community, and there's lots of interest in, of course, Sun Money, lots of interest in Bitcoin. You wouldn't imagine. I mean, most Germany has more Bitcoin nodes than the US right now. And so thank you very much. last question, two questions. Where can we find you? And how do you get any work done with Twitter existing?
Erstens, ich muss sagen, dass ich habe 5 Jahre in Deutsch gelernt auf Hochschule. So, nächste Zeit, ich muss auf Deutsch sprechen.
Das wäre großartig. We should do that. We should do that. And I think you once told me that you come from a German family, right?
Yeah, my grandfather emigrated to America. He was from Transylvania Saxon. So he emigrated to America. His father emigrated to America in, I want to say, the early part of the 1900s. So his oldest brother was born back in the old country. But yeah, he spoke fluent German. In fact, he was a translator. He was being trained to serve in World War II, and then they found out he spoke fluent German from home, and they immediately pulled him out and sent him to the State Department to translate German intelligence documents during World War II. But my German is not good enough to do it yet, but it was maybe someday. But at any rate, to answer the question, you can find me online, fftt-llc.com, which is, and you can find out about our mass market products, as well as our institutional products there and what we're up to. And then Twitter, I'm at Luke Groman, LukeGromen. And how do I get any work done with Twitter? It is at times challenging because it's such a valuable resource, but it's also, like you note, it can be an incredible time sink if you're not careful.
I don't know how to deal with it. So I'm going to ask everybody I talk to. Maybe we'll find a solution. Luke, thank you so much. We'll have to be doing this again in a couple of months. We'll see how we get there. Thank you for taking the time. This was amazing.
Danke fürs Zuhören bei dieser Folge von Was Bitcoin bringt. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, bitte hinterlasst uns 5 Sterne bei Apple und bei Spotify, folgt uns auf YouTube, schickt uns eure Eindrücke, eure Ideen, eure Anregungen, eure Vorschläge für Gäste und natürlich auch eure Kritik an hallo@wasbitcoinbringt.com. Was nicht unerwähnt bleiben darf, natürlich auch Value for Value. Dieser Podcast läuft über das Lightning-Netzwerk in allen Kanälen. Man kann streamen, man kann spenden. Es gibt einen Spenden-Button auch auf wasbitcoinbringt.com inzwischen. Und diese Dinge sind auch wahnsinnig motivierend, wenn da ein bisschen was reinkommt, wenn jeder das nutzt. Es macht wirklich viel Freude, als Bitcoiner für Bitcoiner zu arbeiten.
Die Veröffentlichungen in diesem Podcast sowie die darin enthaltenen Hinweise, die im Begleitmaterial gesetzten Links, dienen ausschließlich Informationszwecken und stellen weder eine Anlageberatung, Anlageanalyse noch eine Aufforderung oder Empfehlung zum Erwerb oder Verkauf von Finanzinstrumenten dar. Insbesondere kann eine Anlage oder sonstige Beratung dadurch nicht ersetzt werden. Die in den Veröffentlichungen erhaltenen Angaben basieren auf dem Wissensstand zum Zeitpunkt der Ausarbeitung und können jederzeit ohne weitere Benachrichtigungen geändert werden. Die Inhalte richten sich ausschließlich an natürliche Personen. Es wird keine Haftung für die Richtigkeit, Vollständigkeit oder Aktualität der zur Verfügung gestellten Informationen, Informationsquellen, daraus resultierenden Haftungen oder Schäden jedweder Art übernommen. Eine Haftung für leicht fahrlässiges Verhalten wird jedenfalls ausgeschlossen.